Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we are strapping in for some serious textual sleuthing.
We are. This one goes deep into ancient scripture, modern biblical criticism, and what happens when those two things collide.
And it's all about one specific passage, the long ending of Mark, and its utterly mind-boggling appearance in the Book of Mormon.
That's right. We're looking at what you could only call an anachronism on steroids.
An anachronism on steroids. I like that. So what's the passage?
It's Mark 16, verses 9 through 20. It's a passage that, you know, scholars almost universally agree is a late addition to the Gospel of Mark. It wasn't original.
And yet, this exact passage, almost word for word from the King James Version, shows up in Mormon chapter 9.
An allegedly ancient American text written supposedly centuries before the New Testament even existed.
So our mission today is to unpack that. We're going to walk you through the three layers of just how improbable this is. We'll look at the scholarly consensus on Mark 16, show why its inclusion in the Book of Mormon is such a huge problem, and then...
And then we'll critically examine the apologetic arguments that try to sort of explain this all away.
Okay, so let's start with the source material itself, the Gospel of Mark. Most people who read the Bible know the ending, right? Where Jesus appears to Mary Magdalene.
Right. But what they might not know is that the scholarly world is incredibly clear on this. That ending, specifically verses 9 through 20, is not original. It's an editorial patch job. It was added later.
And this isn't some fringe theory?
Oh, not at all. This isn't really a theological debate anymore. It's a matter of textual evidence. It's so well established that if you pick up a modern academic Bible, you'll see a footnote or brackets around that section.
What do the notes say?
They'll say something like, these verses are absent from the most reliable early manuscripts and other ancient witnesses.
So why do we trust those early manuscripts so much? Why are they the gold standard?
Well, think of it like this. If you want to know what an author originally wrote, you want the copies that are closest in time to that author, right?
The earliest ones you can find.
Exactly. And for the New Testament, we have these incredible Greek manuscripts from the 4th century. They're considered our best witnesses. And those documents, they just stop at verse 8 of Mark, or they have a totally different, shorter ending.
So it's like finding the original blueprints for a house, and they're both missing a room that only shows up in copies made centuries later.
That's a perfect analogy. The earlier documents just speak louder about what was originally there.
And it's not just that the verses are missing. There are clues inside the text itself that point to a different author, right?
Yes, there are some key forensic markers here. First, as we said, they're absent in the best manuscripts. But second, the vocabulary and the grammar, they just shift dramatically.
How so?
The New Testament scholar Bart Ehrman, he points out that the author of verses 9 through 20 uses a bunch of words and phrases, I think it's something like 18 distinct items, that are found nowhere else in the first 16 chapters of Mark.
It's a completely different literary fingerprint.
It really is. And the narrative flow is just broken. It's awkward.
You're talking about the Mary Magdalene example.
Yes. In verse 9, Mary is introduced. Now, when Jesus was risen early the first day of the week, he appeared first to Mary Magdalene. Well, the original author of Mark had just mentioned her 2 verses earlier.
So reintroducing her as if she had not been mentioned yet makes zero sense if it's the same person writing.
None at all. It's a clear sign that a second writer is trying to sort of reboot the ending.
Let's read that original ending because it's famous for being so abrupt. The original Gospel of Mark ends at chapter 16, verse 8. The women flee the tomb, and it says they were terrified, and neither said they anything to any man, for they were afraid.
And that's it. It just stops.
No triumphant appearance, no great commission. It just ends.
Which, for a religious text, is pretty unsatisfying. So verse 9 comes in and completely ignores that fear and silence and just launches into this traditional resurrection story.
So why would a scribe do that? Why fix what Mark wrote?
This gets into the evolution of Christology.
Okay, so define Christology in this context. Is it just the story of Jesus, or is it something more theological?
It's more theological. It's how the understanding of who Jesus was, his identity, his status developed over the decades. Mark was probably the earliest gospel.
And as time went on, the resurrection story got grander.
Precisely. The later gospels, Matthew and Luke, they already fixed Mark's abrupt ending with their own more detailed accounts. So it seems like later scribes, maybe in the 2nd century, just couldn't stand that Mark ended on this note of fear. They needed a bigger finale.
So they tacked on what we now call the long ending of Mark. It was a theological fix.
It was. So to recap, we know Mark 16.9:20 is, without any real doubt, a late addition, a scribe's patch job.
Okay, now let's pivot. Why is this patch job a complete catastrophe when it shows up in the Book of Mormon? This is where we get to that triple anachronism.
This is the core of it right here. It's not one problem. It's three layers of historical impossibility all stacked on top of each other.
Let's compare the texts directly. We're looking at the signs that follow believers. Mark 16, verses 17 and 18 says,
"They shall cast out devils, they shall speak with new tongues, they shall take up serpents, and if they drink any deadly thing, it shall not hurt them."
Okay. Now, here's Mormon chapter 9, verse 24. This is from an alleged ancient American record.
And it says, "And these signs shall follow them that believe in my name. They shall cast out devils, they shall speak with new tongues, they shall take up serpents, and if they drink any deadly thing, it shall not hurt them."
It's nearly identical. The phrasing, the grammar, it's all there, straight from the King James Bible. Which brings us to layer one, the KJV language anachronism.
Exactly. The Book of Mormon is supposedly from 600 BC to 421 AD, translated from gold plates. But it's filled with word-for-word language from a Bible translation that wasn't made until 1611 AD.
And one could argue, well, couldn't divine translation just use contemporary language?
It's not just that it's 19th century language. It's specifically 17th century King James language, with all its archaic quirks. And even more damning is the pattern of the Book of Mormon copying the KJV's specific translation errors.
And the italics. Let's talk about the italics.
Yes, the italics. The King James translators added words in italics to make the English flow better words that were not in the original Greek or Hebrew.
And those italicized added words appear in the Book of Mormon.
They do. Which is pretty solid proof that the source text wasn't ancient gold plates, but the 1611 English Bible itself. You don't accidentally translate the editorial notes of a 17th century committee.
So that's layer one. Layer two is the New Testament material anachronism.
Right. Even if you ignore the KJV language, the content itself, the specific teachings about Jesus shouldn't be there. The Book of Mormon peoples, the Nephites, they supposedly left Jerusalem long before the New Testament was even written.
They wouldn't have had access to this material.
None. Yet the text is filled with New Testament concepts, phrasing, and doctrine. It strongly suggests a 19th century author who was steeped in that theology.
Which brings us to layer three, the steroids part of this anachronism, the late biblical edition anachronism.
This is the real kicker. It combines the first two. It's not just KJV phrasing of authentic New Testament material.
It's KJV phrasing of a late non-original scribal patch job.
Exactly. The author of the Book of Mormon took a 17th century translation that included a 2nd century scribal error and then presented that entire flawed package as pristine ancient scripture from the Americas.
So if Moroni, an ancient prophet, wrote this down, he somehow had access to a non-original piece of the Bible centuries before it was even written down by a scribe. That just turns the whole timeline on its head.
It does. It means the author was treating the King James Bible as if it were a perfect, infallible historical record, warts and all, and just importing it directly into an ancient American setting.
Okay, so that brings us to the critique. When defenders of the Book of Mormon are faced with this triple anachronism, how do they respond? What do organizations like Fair Mormon say?
They often deploy what we'd call a smokescreen. It's designed to shift your focus away from the really obvious textual evidence of copying. There are a couple of main defenses.
Let's start with the first one. Questioning the consensus.
Right. They'll argue that the scholarly consensus against Mark 16 isn't totally absolute. They'll cite several scholars who suggest that maybe the original gospel had a longer ending that got lost.
Okay, but that sounds like a distraction. How is that a defense?
It is a distraction because it doesn't matter if there was some hypothetical lost original ending. The problem is that the specific text that shows up in the Book of Mormon is the known, proven, inauthentic replacement text.
The one with the different vocabulary and the awkward transition.
That's the one. They're trying to create doubt about the Bible to distract from the Book of Mormon's obvious reliance on the KJV.
So what's defense number two?
This one is based on circular logic and, really, source denial. They argue that Moroni's source wasn't Mark's gospel at all.
So where did he get it from?
From the teachings of Christ recorded among the Nephites. So they say the authenticity of Mormon chapter 9 doesn't depend on Mark's authenticity.
But then they take it a step further, don't they?
They do. They pivot and suggest that the Book of Mormon actually validates the long ending of Mark. They say, see, it must be true because it's also in our ancient record.
Wow. So let me get this straight. We assume the Book of Mormon is true, which proves its content is true, which then validates the late edition to Mark. But the whole reason we're having this discussion is because the Book of Mormon is using Mark's late edition.
It's textbook circular reasoning. A is true because B is true, and B is true because A is true. It completely insulates the text from any external evidence or scrutiny.
To believe that, you have to ignore all the other evidence. The identical phrasing, the KJV errors, the italics.
You have to suspend the common sense idea that if two texts share unique errors, one was almost certainly copying the other.
There's also that footnote argument, right? Where they try to claim Joseph Smith couldn't have been copying from a Bible.
Yes, that's a classic. An editorial footnote claims, without evidence, that it is unreasonable to believe that Joseph either opened a Bible or had memorized these long passages.
But that's just special pleading.
It is. If a student turns in a paper with a huge word-for-word section from a modern textbook, the professor doesn't need a video of the student copying it. The text itself is the evidence.
So, to wrap this up, this whole deep dive really shows a recurring pattern, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
The Book of Mormon's content just continually points back to 19th century authorship.
It does. It relies on the specific biblical texts that were available at that time, complete with their errors, their formatting, and their late additions, things that an ancient American prophet just shouldn't have had access to.
The long ending of Mark isn't a one-off issue. It's just one of the clearest, most textually undeniable examples of this reliance on a very specific and impure 17th century English source.
And that leaves us with a final provocative thought for you to think about. If the translation process was truly miraculous, if it was channeling the pure word of Jesus from pristine gold plates through a seer stone, why would that divine revelation consistently align word for word with the errors, the italics, and the non-original scribal additions found in one specific 17th century English Bible?
You're left with two options, really. Divine revelation that just happens to perfectly mirror human error, or a 19th century text relying on contemporary sources.
Exactly. At the end of the day, you have to ask which explanation is more logical. Which one requires fewer extraordinary assumptions? It's a classic case for Occam's razor.